the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Elaine Burke, who you meet every week on TV and streaming on a Monday, is with us for the week trending tonight. And Paddy Duffy, a freelance TV producer, is with us as well. And it's with a movie I want to start. Carol Doherty and myself were talking last night about the incredible popularity of The Odyssey in Irish cinemas. Although I believe neither of you has seen it yet.
No, because you have to schedule 3 hours out of your day to go and watch it. And
I've booked for next Monday night. I'm going next Monday night.
I just haven't had that time. And I would like to see it in a big screen. And a lot of the big screen screenings of it are selling out. That's the
IMAX,
other issue
that's the one
as well.
I booked the IMAX. Now, the reason I bring this up is because people like Elon Musk have started a major campaign against the movie. It's a campaign in advance that has failed, because if you see the box office numbers, not just in Ireland, but internationally, it is a stunning success, despite the complaints that he has made against it. And I see he's still at it. And what is he now threatening to do, Paddy?
Yes, the latest in the stories that make you think that Elon Musk has been kicked in the head by a horse is that he has been accusing Christopher Nolan, the director, of anti-white racism. This is because, in essence, this all boils down to the fact that Lupita Nyong'o, who is a Kenyan-American actress, is playing Helen of Troy. And he insists that he will make... Now, initially, he wanted Mel Gibson to do this, and then immediately then went on to say, no, he could do it himself via... you know, his magical
website. So he wanted Mel Gibson to do the remake.
He wanted to do it a remake in the same way that they did like The Passion of the Christ or Apocalypto, like in the classic, you know, Greek style and all this sort of stuff. And
then I did see somebody making the point, they did a list of all the historical and factual inaccuracies in Braveheart, which was utter fiction.
Well, now, this is the thing. I mean, like, hands up if you can spot the problem here. He said that he insisted that his version will be historically accurate. Now, there's not a huge amount of history to roll upon. Like, the whole thing is story. And to underline that, the problem that he has with Lupita Nyong'o playing Helen of Troy now, in the stories, in the legends and the lore, Helen of Troy was the child of Leda and Zeus, who had shapeshifted into a swan. So now, maybe the anti-white...
A black swan or a white swan?
Well, indeed, maybe the anti-white racism refers to like an anti-swan stance from Christopher Nolan. But I think the thing about this is that, you know, yet again, I think there's something really interesting about this, because The Odyssey, in a lot of ways, it's the ultimate story. It's so many other stories that we're aware of have their origin in The Odyssey. And now, whether that be in terms of sort of broad-based set of things, like, you know, any kind of hero arc, any kind of arc of redemption, any kind of, I suppose, Shaggy Dog story has its roots in The Odyssey. And then more literally, like Ulysses and James Joyce or the Coen brothers, O Brother, Where Art Thou? It is a very, very durable story, and it can take all sorts of shapes. And what underpins it really is that Elon Musk can't create. He can only really riff on things that have already happened. Now, he dropped a trailer for his Grok-produced Ulysses. And it's like something like some sort of like Bible story from the 90s, some sort of like Touched by an Angel kind of, you know, like life, you know, sort of Hallmark Channel sort of stuff from the 90s. It's so
That's actually peculiar. A trope in AI-generated video.
Really?
Yeah, it's quite odd. They skew heavily towards these strange Christian religious archetypes. If you see a lot of like this automated cartoons and stuff like that that come into TikTok feeds, they have a lot of those themes in them.
Okay,
you know, so like a winged Jesus coming to rescue babies and stuff like that.
Okay, so what is Musk playing at here? I mean, is part of this a way to try and promote Grok as the AI tool? Because Grok would appear to be so far behind everyone else that it's going to be an also-ran, isn't it, in popular artificial intelligence?
I mean, it's ahead on nudifying.
So sorry?
It's ahead on nudifying women. It's doing really well there.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're leading in some areas of AI generation, areas that are going to be banned as of December 2026 in the EU. But Elon Musk's goal, I think, is always to have Elon Musk in the headlines, and he succeeds every time.
And I think
so take on the biggest hit of the summer in terms of the filmmaking world, and you will attract more headlines. And
yeah, but what does it also say, Elaine, though, about sort of the cultural thing, that he attracts this mob that then follows him and tries to make an issue of this, that, you know, fighting culture wars, or even things like a bloody movie?
Here's what's something that's really interesting about this. So I left Twitter a long time ago. I haven't been on the site in so long. Mm. And I was vaguely aware that this was something that was happening, but it seemed to be completely isolated to Twitter. No one was talking about this woke odyssey stuff outside of that Twitter ecosystem. So now they're all just corralled in there yelling at each other. Now, there's still a lot of journalists that work inside that bubble and see that as reflective of the general discourse. But the more you remove yourself from it, the more you realize it's really not reflective of the general discourse. Mm. This conversation was not happening outside of Twitter. And in Twitter, on Twitter, it was obviously fueled by Elon Musk himself.
Yeah, Elon Musk's his whole thing, I think, is to essentially to whitewash culture. And when he says things like this, it's an essentially trying to activate the kind of people that consider history to be their piece of the rock, but actually don't love history all that much. It's the same thing where, you know, like if you have like something like Yellowstone and they have the, it features a black cowboy and people going, oh, this is wokeness gone mad. When in actual fact, if people were genuinely interested in the history, they know full well that one in four cowboys were black over the in the 19th century.
And wasn't there a black cowboy in Blazing Saddles?
There was a black cowboy in Blazing
the
Saddles.
Sheriff.
There certainly was, yeah, and the sheriff no less, yeah. So I think, yeah, whenever they do this sort of thing, I mean, it's fundamentally bad faith is the first thing that you have to do. And they have very much an agenda behind it. Because as we've seen, they have no real concern for the history. They have no real concern for storytelling. And, you know, if he wanted to make his own version of the Odyssey, he could do it, but he's having to rely on these, like, yeah, winged Jesus tropes from, you know, that are 30 years old.
Dan says, I saw the Odyssey today. All I can say is that Elon Musk will need to go to ground next spring because the movie is going to sweep every award going. And I'm a teacher of classical studies, says Dan. Okay. Of course, there is another Odyssey-related story. Tell us about what's happened or what complaint the owner of a Viking ship used in the movie has made, Elaine.
Yeah, so the Viking warship, and I'm going to attempt to pronounce it here, Glad Elf Gilberga, was used in the filming of the Odyssey. I don't think it's one of the main ships, but it's one of the cast of ships that they use. So this is a real replica ship of an ancient ship from around 1040. And they sent it back damaged, basically. Like, this ship has been on the sea, by the way, and has survived many, many years, but they gave it to a film production company and it came back with $6,000 worth of damage that they took upon themselves and the owners of the replica. And they also volunteered their time but charged Universal for the parts. So they volunteered their labour, but they asked for compensation for the parts, and they're still waiting for that bill to be paid. Now, Universal claims that it has been paid in full, and there seems to be some sort of misunderstanding here. But yeah, this is very familiar, Paddy, being a freelancer. This is,
yes,
like a
absolutely.
Tale as old as time.
Who among us?
this story rang a lot of familiar bells for me, and I'm sure for you as well.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. It's, yeah, it can be rather Kafkaesque at times, and I imagine the bigger the company and the more that they can afford it, the harder it is to get any money out of them. But, you know, just for a bit of context on that, the Glad of Gilberga, it's having done a bit of television development in the Viking space, if you like. This ship is serious business. It's a real rock star kind of in the historical and archaeological world because of sort of the nature of how they found it. Roskilde was a really important area for Viking discovery. And yeah, it doesn't speak well, I think, to Universal that they've managed to sort of tally up $6,000. Even, you know, even if they insist they've paid it, it's not great form, is it?
Mm. Okay, I'm going to go to a story from Spain, Elaine, which I imagine will be of interest to many Irish people who go there for their holidays. Now, this is not happening immediately, but the Spanish government has approved a draft law that would ban smoking and vaping in outdoor spaces, including bar terraces, parks and beaches. Mm-hmm. Now, they're also banning minors from consuming tobacco and the rest of it, and it's things to do with advertising promotion. But that idea that you couldn't even go out of the restaurant or out of the bar that you might be in to have a smoke or a vape in an outdoor space, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, similar conversations would have happened when Ireland brought in its smoking ban in bars and workplaces and things like that. It was a radical move when we did it, and there was lots of contention about it and lots of people who thought it'd be a bad idea. But overall, it's been great. I'm not a smoker myself, so I'm coming from that point of view. I also have quite weak lungs as well, so I couldn't be around people who are smoking. I wouldn't be able to socialise in a world that existed before that smoking ban. So I'm very grateful that it exists. And I'm aware that when I go abroad and you remember, oh God, there's smoking in bars here. And it feels actually like a relic of the past now when I encounter bars like that. And in Spain, like, they have the same problems everywhere else has. They are accounting for 50,000 deaths a year, and that smoking is a risk factor in around 30% of cancers. So they're trying this as a public health effort, and you're seeing efforts like this of trying to move towards what's called a tobacco-free generation. That's what their health minister has described it as. And I believe in the UK, they're trying to increase the age of permission to be able to access smoking so that they can also move towards...
So will you only be allowed to smoke in your own home?
Essentially, that's what it looks like. Yeah, it's really like enclosing smoking to private areas and private spaces. And the thing about smoking is a lot of people who do it do want to stop. And the more you're actually limited to do it in general life, that might actually help.
Paddy, I wonder, would there be moves to ever do this in Ireland? I know a lot of people very much like the smoking areas outdoors in a lot of Irish bars and restaurants. A lot of the people there argue there's more crack there than there is inside.
Yes,
but,
yeah,
you know, some businesses ban smoking within 50 yards of the front of their thing. I don't know whether they legally can do that, but they tell their employees. And the one that always gets me, I can never understand why it is that hospitals don't ban smoking outside. And because I notice this particularly when I go to the respiratory unit up in Tala for my twice yearly visit, I'm always taken by the amount of people who are in either wheelchairs or in their dressing gowns outside having a cigarette as inpatients in the hospital.
That is a bizarre state of affairs. It really is. I mean, could it happen here? I think it absolutely could. I mean, it is interesting that, you know, Minister Garcia said that, you know, the aim is to make clean air the norm in public spaces. And I think a lot of that is in the 20 odd years that we've had, instead of in terms of like the public health benefits of smoking. We have seen, I suppose, a few things that maybe transform. So, you know, from pure tobacco to vapes, for example. And then, yeah, so this idea of moving the crack, or at least the smoke outside. I think it absolutely could happen here. And I think
I suspect the Restaurants Association, the publicans and everything would go absolutely crazy if they thought that they weren't allowed to have outdoor areas in which people could smoke, and would fight it to the hilt.
I suspect they would, but then again, they did exactly the same in 2004. And what's interesting, although what is interesting here is that in terms of the stats, apparently now, I suppose, is anyone that goes on holiday instead of, and say, at least anecdotally, feel like maybe people smoke more on the continent. 26% of Spain's adult population apparently smoke. And interestingly, the draft law that they're bringing in, they reckon it might not have the votes. So, I mean, yes, I suppose whoever would bring it in, and I mean, it would be quite opposite, I suppose, if Micheál Martin was to bring it in, being the health minister that brought it in the first instance. But certainly, as we've seen, where, you know, around the clamour for, you know, local pubs and things like that, and the alcohol limit and whatnot, you would have to negotiate a fairly well organised opposition. But I certainly think that we're a case of good practice in terms of getting that sort of thing over the line.
Elaine, tell us why it is that the Listún Varna matchmaking festival can't get a licence extension until 2:30 in the morning.
Because of competing Garda resources. So Listún Varna runs for basically the entire month of September. And also happening in that part of the world in September is the Amgen Irish Open in Doonbeg and the Walker Cup in Lahinch. And it seems that resources are expected to be spread too thin to account for later opening hours. So District Court Judge Adrian Harris has said that they'll have to get their courting done early in the pubs because they can't have the extension. And keeping all things fair as well, the same judge did also reject an application from the Walker Cup in Lahinch Golf Club to increase their opening hours to 2 a.m. So it's not that he's privileging anyone here. They're just trying to manage resources.
Okay, Listún Varna, they still have till 1:30 in the morning. And is that all the nights of the weekend over the 4 weekends?
Well, that'll be, yeah. So, I mean, this is what sort of struck me as interesting. It's like, how much drinking time and curtain time do you need? You know, like, I'm mindful of that quote that's attributed to Paolo Maldini about the art of defence. He goes, like, if you need to make a tackle, you're in the wrong position anyway. And I sort of feel like it's a bit the same for this, really. I mean, I think you should kind of have, you know, you should have all your plamacin, you know, fairly, you know, sort of tightly wound up by 1:30 anyway, I would say. Also, though, what strikes me as really interesting is that exactly how raucous is the Listún Varna Festival? You know, you would, maybe I'm labouring under a misapprehension about the over-under of the people that are attending here, but I wouldn't think that there'd be a huge and onerous you know, sort of force on the Gardaí, sort of being out till half two anyway. So it's, you know, I don't know, maybe it's absolute all, every man and woman for themselves up there. I don't know.
Okay. Hey, Elaine, you wanted to talk about something that's planned for Trinity College and the library in December.
This is a kind of incredible. So if people aren't aware, Jonathan Anderson, the Irish designer, is head of Dior these days. Christian Dior's fashion house, one of the most famous fashion houses worldwide. And he is going to be displaying the latest collection in December in the Long Room of Trinity College. The Long Room as well, if people aren't familiar with it, is one of the most beautiful locations in the city centre by a long shot. It's very historic, very grand. And even the invitation to this event kind of harks back to Irishness. It is a drawing of a four-leaf clover, but they also have a quote from Carmel Snow, who I didn't realise was a Dublin-born journalist.
Who's Carmel Snow?
Well, she was the editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar in the 40s. And in 1947, Christian Dior famously came out with this kind of new line called the New Look. But she actually coined the term. I didn't realise this. She wrote, "It's quite a revolution, dear Christian. Your dresses have such a new look." And that's the defining characteristic of that 1947 collection. It turned around the fortunes of that fashion house, and it was a really big moment in fashion.
And so how big a deal that is that in the 21st century, is the launch of a fashion line by someone like Dior?
It's, well, I mean, these days it's all gone so inaccessible. Like, you know, you wouldn't have a Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris now. She'd need a lot more money to get one of these dresses.
But sorry, that was a movie a few years ago.
With Leslie Manville, and she goes to Paris to get herself a Dior dress. It's very delightful. Okay. But this is a form of art really now. What you're going to see here is the haute couture of the world descending on Dublin. And maybe Zendaya will be here. I don't know. That would be so exciting. But it's... yeah, it's not going to change things for like what's going to be in store for Irish people to buy and stuff like that. This is a moment in the high art of fashion. I think that's worth appreciating. But also, like, you do have this trickle down effect of like Irish designers and Irish fashion being really hot at the moment. Olivia Dean, when she was here doing her Marley Park tour, was pictured wearing Ditzy Bits clothing, which has these Clada designs on it. It was a really great moment for them. There's also an Italian sportswear brand called CP Company, which do these funny kind of warped screen prints of GAA jerseys that are really popular. Like, I've seen Nia Archives, a UK artist, wearing them. They're really cool looking, these things. And, you know, the O'Neill shorts being famous by Paul Mescal and Only in Normal People. Everyone loves those tiny little shorts now. So, like, there's a real moment happening for Irish fashion as well. And I think that's part of this event and feeds into it as well.
And of course, Jonathan Anderson was also the man that created Sabrina Carpenter's dress for the Met Gala this year, which was made of essentially kind of negatives from the film, the Audrey Hepburn film, Sabrina. And it was much lauded at the time, probably one of the, I think, probably one of the highlights, I think, of the Met Gala this year. So it's definitely having a big, he's definitely having a big impact sort of in the celebrity world. He really is the man for the moment. And of course, he is the son of the Irish rugby international, Willie Anderson, as well. So it's where the world's colliding of sport and haute couture is always something. But, and I will say as well that Carmel Snow, to the best of my knowledge, is also a big champion of Sybil Connolly, who was a dressmaker sort of back in the 40s and 50s, who was known as the Dublin Dior. So it's there's definitely a lot of history to pull on here for Jonathan.
And as it happens, Willie on this programme previously has spoken about his great pride in his son, who's in his early 40s now, I think, at this stage. Yeah. He's been around in the fashion business for a while. Now, Paddy, tell us about Gary Lineker and the UK millionaires who want to pay higher taxes.
Yeah, this is a group called the Patriotic Millionaires, and presumably they're a little bit embarrassed by the Scrooge McDuck antics of Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Larry Ellison and all these people that are, you know, intent on sort of scrounging up all their money. And they have insisted that they've essentially said to the new Prime Minister, you know, "Dear Mr. Burnham, tax us more, put us in a higher band. We're good for it. A wealth tax is exactly what the country needs. You know, things need to be resourced, and we're more than happy to pony up." And what's interesting, I've had a bit of a laugh, I have to say, about some of the signatories, because they include Gary Lineker himself. They include Richard Curtis, who wrote Notting Hill, Ian Gregg of Gregg's the Baker's fame, and Val McDermid, who is a good pal of mine. We do a radio show together on
Radio 4. She's been a guest here on the programme previously, the crime writer,
yeah. And she's a lovely woman, and we've been on a Radio 4 show for many years now. But I tell you, whenever you see a pal on a list of millionaires, every drink and every round you've ever bought kind of flashes before your eyes. And so I've just spent the last couple of days since
I saw this. Instead of paying higher taxes, should she have been spending more money in buying you drink?
I think it's only fair. I think, yeah, you know, it's, you know, I think two things can happen at the same time. But I think it's definitely, it's an interesting direction of travel. There was, I suppose, a clamour for this sort of around the time of the credit crunch, like the Robin Hood tax, the Tobin tax, all this sort of stuff. And it kind of never really went anywhere. But it does sort of feel now that the talking points are swinging in the opposite direction. I mean, people are pointing to the likes of, you know, during the Eisenhower era or the Wilson era, that, you know, the high band of tax was like way, way up. And it's what an awful lot of people consider to be, you know, the absolute pinnacle of 20th century living and you know, and how well things sort of work there. So it does indicate a certain change in direction. And I mean, it's also underlined by the fact that Andy Burnham is kind of saying, in essence, the Thatcher era is over. So it's very interesting that these two things are coming together at the same time.
Anything to add to that, Elaine?
Yeah, I mean, it's great because you do need that weight to the argument. If you want things like a wealth tax to come on board, you do need the wealthy to actually be weighing in on it, in favour of it, I think, for there to be any move on it. So,
all the tech bros in California have been completely complaining about the idea that they might be subjected to a wealth tax.
Yeah, well, good enough for them. And but the idea here is, like, you often get when governments are asked to consider something like this, that they say, like, it will be harmful to our economy because then people won't want to come here and build wealth. So this is a cohort of people who've built wealth saying that they would be happy to pay more taxes. And it does progress the argument, I think.
Of course, a lot of rich British people head to Dubai. No, I mean, you talk about Gary Lineker. Isn't Rio Ferdinand one of those who has headed off there in the past? But tell us about how Dubai is now trying to persuade people to get people who live there, to get others to come and visit.
Yes, it's Dubai has often been a place where, I suppose, the phrase more money than sense would maybe sort of come to mind for me. But it's in recent times, obviously, Dubai is kind of in a difficult position, being given its proximity to the Strait of Hormuz. And so it's had an awful lot of flights cancelled. It's had an awful lot of then, and that's had a huge amount of a domino effect. So they're now offering to pay residents who can attract family and friends to visit. And they call it the Dubai Invite Scheme. And they can nominate friends and relatives to receive sort of various benefits to the tune of 3,000 UAE dirham. And if your exchange rate isn't on point, that's about 610 sterling pounds to visit. And so they'll get like benefits packages and all that sort of thing. And now what's interesting about this for me is that it looks like sort of Dubai is kind of going in two separate ways with this. A couple of places are just closing down and sort of using the shortfall as an opportunity to sort of maybe, you know, regenerate, sort of do a bit of, you know, do a bit of sort of touching up work, that sort of thing. But then a lot of them are going full fathom for this. And apparently in the first 48 hours of it, they got 10,000 applications. So maybe money's winning over sense again. Who knows?
I have to leave it there. Paddy Duffy, Elaine Burke, thank you.
The last word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.